From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums. This is Digital Campus number 32 for the 22nd of September, 2008. Going Native. I'm Dan Cohen. And we're back for yet another episode of Digital Campus. And this week we don't have guests, but it was great to have Brian Alexander from Nightly on last time. But I am here with Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly, of course. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
Hope your semesters are starting off well. And it was a good discussion last time about Chrome. Has anyone tried Chrome?
Yeah, I have. I downloaded it onto my to my wife's PC, and it is very nice. It's very, very fast, and there's some new features, and the user interface is somewhat different than the conventional browser, but it's actually very, very intuitive really, really slick. I like it. I'm really eager for it to come out on Mac and Linux, so I can maybe give it a little more of a banging on. But it's so far so good.
Mills, tried it out too?
I haven't tried it yet, just because our home computer, although it's a PC, it's so ancient that downloading anything else onto it would kill it, and then I use a Mac at work.
Right. Well, not to get too obsessive about Google, but we have This Week in Google. Should we rename the podcast This Week in Google? It seems like there was some interesting Google news, but lots of other news too. So a lot to get into. Let's dig into the news roundup, as we always do at the beginning of the podcast. Well, in addition to coming out with their new browser, Chrome, looks like they're also expanding their digitization efforts into newspapers. Mills, you've been covering this, and you think it's a pretty interesting development for historians.
I think it's a really exciting development for historians because, first of all, their plans are very ambitious, as they always are at Google, and there are just so many tens of thousands of small newspapers out there that otherwise wouldn't get digitized. So for instance, when I had ambitions of being a news reporter back in college, I covered the Democratic National Convention for the La Crosse, Wisconsin Tribune.
Wow.
Now, and I'm sure you both read that on a regular basis, but the only way to you can't actually get copies of it at the Library of Congress. The only way you can – I wanted to get a copy of the stories that I wrote back in 1980, and so the only way to get it was to call the newspaper in Wisconsin and ask them to be – very nicely go into their morgue and dig the stories out and copy them and send them to me. So that's the kind of newspaper that's going to get scanned. And for students and for historians, access to this vast corpus of local newspapers is just going to really, really change things, I think.
Oh, I see. So this isn't for the New York Times of the world. This is for something else.
That's my understanding. I mean, the New York Times is already available through ProQuest and or the New York Times. And so, if ProQuest has all the major newspapers already locked up, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times. So my understanding is that Google's plan is to just scan as many newspapers as they can get their hands on.
And with the standard sort of Google quid pro quo that they have of, we'll do this for free for you. All you have to do is give us your stuff. Is there something ominous here that at least some people might pick up on, or is this just a net gain
I think it's a complete net gain. Have you ever tried to work with a newspaper from 1890, let's say?
Right.
Oh, they're crumbling.
Right.
And the La Crosse, Wisconsin Tribune has no resources to maintain those crumbling pages. And so all those newspapers are going to vanish pretty soon if somebody doesn't scan them. And ProQuest isn't going to do it because there's no cost recovery model in their business model for scanning small town newspapers. But Google has a whole different system.
I mean, I agree that it's a net gain. It's better than what we have now. That's for certain. What I don't know about is you know, Google has this sort of ethos of providing open access to knowledge. And while they do that, and while this newspaper project will do that, it doesn't provide complete open access to that knowledge. I mean, they will have some link buried in the pull-down menu of the homepage that is something like Google Newspapers. You'll go there. There'll be a search box. You'll be able to type in a simple search, and you'll get back a list of search results with links to page images of these newspapers. But what you won't get are, and Dan, you've written about this, you won't be able to get a full text dump of the content to do any kind of more sophisticated data mining on. You won't get any kinds of APIs so that you can mash this content up with other kinds of services. You won't get any rights to use these materials in other kinds of websites and to do more sophisticated interpretive things with. So they give you kind of a basic level of open access, but they don't provide any real services on top of that. And my problem with that is, if the library sign up for this, it's not an exclusive contract, so it's not that they couldn't do something more, it's that they won't do something more. They'll think that by signing this deal with Google, they'll have done their duty. And I'm not sure that that's the case. Just providing a search box with, and then a list of hits, is really the full job of these institutions and what we should be doing as cultural heritage professionals. So that's my problem with all of these Google initiatives, Google Books, Google Scholar, all of them.
Well, yeah, you know, I have been writing about this. In fact, I think the very first post to my blog in 2005 was about the need for better means of access into these digitized collections, or namely in the case that I did on my blog about application programming interfaces, or APIs. And strangely enough, Tom, that you mentioned that, I actually just got an email this morning from someone at Rutgers University sort of asking about, well, has anything happened on this front with Google? And I said, no. You know, it's incredible. The interface to Google Books hasn't changed in years. I mean, there's a new homepage where you can kind of browse through the stacks, as it were. But there's no sophisticated interface to the collection. And one anticipates they're going to keep that stripped down, and Google only interface their collection. And indeed, that is the big problem, at least for doing sophisticated kinds of research and analysis of this collection, which definitely will be incredible. So you're left with just the sort of finding the needle in the haystack use case. That is taken care of. But more sophisticated things, much harder to see how that's going to happen.
Right. And what's sinister here is that the fact of the matter is that Google does have that more sophisticated access. They do have that increased access, but they're the only ones that have it. That's my problem. And these are public resources, and that's my problem with them.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think they're a little bit, schizophrenic about this, aren't they? I mean, at the same time, this very same week, one of the stories that came out was that they're now over at Google Scholar, they're adding these green arrows next to open access articles. So when you do a search and you'll get a string of search results, all of a sudden you'll notice that there are these green arrows next to things that are open, fully open, that you can go and grab and download. Is Google just sort of schizophrenic in this way? I mean, they've got Google Code, which is this huge repository of open source software. They actually have Chris DeBono, sort of a very famous open source developer who kind of leads their efforts toward openness. And at the same time, they're sort of closed-fisted with some of their materials, particularly the kinds of materials that we're talking about right now.
You know, before we get on to that, I just wanted to say one other thing about the newspapers, and then I'll let Tom answer that question. I think the quid pro quo issue is one that we need to think about. But I do think that eventually third-party vendors are going to start creating some of these products that we really need. But also, I think it's worth noting that when it comes to newspapers, we're talking about billions of pages of information. And, you know, the National Endowment for the Humanities Division of Preservation and Access has been pumping millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars over the last 20 years into preserving newspapers. And do you know what format they're using to preserve them?
Please let us know.
Microfilm.
Yeah, microfilm.
They are still giving out millions of dollars every year to microfilm newspapers. Okay, so that's what the, you know, that's the landscape for preserving newspapers right now, is that the, you know, big cultural agencies are paying for microfilm, and that's just insane. And so, yes, I'm a little concerned about some of the things that Tom mentioned, but if it doesn't happen soon, these newspapers are just going to turn to dust.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think, Mills, you're absolutely right. I mean, I would certainly say it's better than nothing. But when we're talking about public resources, I don't know if better than nothing should be the standard. And it's the same idea with these open access journals. They put this little green arrow next to open access, which is, I suppose, promoting open access materials. But that's good for the community of scholars and researchers and students and others. But it's also good for Google. They want to shame closed access resources into becoming open access, but not necessarily so that the public, for the greater good of the public. They want these other resources, the work that other institutions have done to digitize resources, to be open access, because they want to index them and they want to have them in their databases. And not necessarily to provide more than just the simple access that they provide now. They want to maintain the more sophisticated access for themselves, and provide the public with this kind of simpler, stripped down access. And I just don't want to end up in a situation. Right now we're in a situation with closed access publications where, wealthy universities that have the money to subscribe to these journals, they have complete access, and the rest of the public has no access. I don't want to end up in a somewhat similar situation where Google has great access to knowledge, and the rest of us have kind of second class access to knowledge. It would be bad if there was one company that gave us kind of limited access, but they had complete access. That I think is kind of problematic.
Yeah, well, at the same time, I think there's this other story from this past week that we noticed on Ars Technica about this backlash against open access, where, maybe Google is somewhere in the middle here, because, you've got all these large publishing companies who are now really trying to push back against this NIH policy, the National Institutes of Health in the United States, which started requiring this year that authors place all of their text and indeed images as well from publications in an NIH database, which is hosted at PubMed Central. And this was a big deal in the open access community to get these things open access, but now they're really fighting back, and they've done lobbying. And indeed, there's now an introduction of legislation. I think it's the U.S. House of Representatives Bill 6845 that actually might end up really essentially eliminating this open access policy through PubMed. Is that where we should be looking if we're looking for evil at really closing off access to these materials? And this was really, I think, that any NIH policy, when that passed, it really filtered down. I mean, we saw after that the Harvard policy toward open access and things happening at other universities. That was a real watershed, wasn't it? And now it seems that policy might be eroded.
Well, I've got absolutely zero sympathy for the publishers on this one, and I think it would just be criminal to change the existing policy, because, first of all three of us paid for those articles. That NIH money didn't come from the companies. It came from you and me. And so the taxpayers of the United States have a right to the access to information that they paid for. If publishers don't want to make that information public, then they shouldn't publish the results of work that was done with taxpayer money. That seems pretty simple and straightforward to me. But then there's another aspect to it, which is, this is really a rich country problem, that medical schools all around the world in third world countries depend on free access to medical information like this. And, they have no money to spend on, Reed Elsevier journals. And so, it's also, from the standpoint of just the United States as a citizen of the world, it's a really bad idea to close access to medical information generated by scholars using money from the National Institute of Health. It's just bad.
Yeah, I have to point out that I think the height of hilarity at this subcommittee meeting on this bill, again, House Bill 6845, was when Howard Berman, who I think was chairing the committee, said that basically compared the NIH with Napster. He said that the N in NIH shouldn't stand for Napster because they were basically the U.S. government was running some kind of, you know, free trade site. I mean, this is medical information here that benefits the world and is paid for by the American taxpayer.
Right. I think that's the key. That's the key point, that it is paid for by the taxpayer. And I think if these publishers want to control the knowledge, then they should be paying for the research, which obviously they can and don't have the money to do. But if we are paying for the research, we as taxpayers and citizens should have access to the products of that research, and these publications are products of that research. So I think this is really evil. I think the difference here, I think you're right, Dan, that probably Google is somewhere in the middle. I mean, Google's, what is their motto? Don't be evil. You know, it's maybe it should be more like don't be as evil as the publishers. But don't be evil doesn't mean that they're necessarily good.
Right, right.
I think that's probably where I come down on this.
Yeah. Well, finally, just to wrap up the news from this week, we saw the founding of a couple of institutions that may be important for listeners of this podcast. One actually does come out of the federal government, and this is the passage of this Digital Promise. This actually happened, I think, a few weeks ago, but I think we haven't had a chance to discuss it on the podcast. But there was I guess this is over the summer, really, but we're just getting to it now. In the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, there was a establishment of a new program, which was sort of vaguely entitled a National Center for Research in Advanced Information and Digital Technologies. And I think they're actually now in the process of trying to find funding for fiscal year 2009. So it's a little unclear what it is. They're asking for $50 million, though. So this is not small, and it will be a congressionally originated, you know, nonprofit corporation that will be located in the Department of Ed. Does anyone get a sense of, you know, maybe we'll have to get someone on the podcast to explain this a little bit better to us, what Digital Promise is going to do?
You know, I met with some of the people from Digital Promise, I don't know, 3 years ago when they were just starting to try to lobby for the approval of this idea. And I think the basic premise that they have is a good one, which is that digital technology is transforming education from K to graduate school in ways that we don't fully understand, and that the federal government needs to actually put some resources behind figuring out best practices in a new educational environment. And so I think that's really their basic operating premise, is that existing programs are, you know, through the Department of Ed or the NEH or whatever, aren't really doing that. And so there needs to be this nexus within the federal government to provide funding to researchers who are looking at how education is being transformed by digital technology, whether it's second grade education or PhD education. And so, you know, I think that's a really good idea. I think that's something that needs to be studied, and it needs that those studies are going on. They're just not being funded right now. And so it would be nice to have some money, serious money, behind looking at that. How it's all going to play out, I have no idea whether it's going to turn out that way.
My only concern with this is that the $50 million that goes to this will be somehow subtracted from the money that's currently going to NEH and NEA and other federal funding agencies for the work, so that the money to study the work that's going on ends up harming the actual work that's going on. That'd be my only worry here, that there's NEH Office of Digital Humanities somehow gets cut because of this. Probably the way that the federal budget is constructed, that won't happen, but it is a little bit of a worry.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable worry, especially now that the federal government is in the insurance and mortgage origination business. So.
We're recording this, our audience should know, as the stock market tanks. So, yes, everything you have will be worth the paper it's printed on, but we'll know a lot more about the digital world, won't we, when this is over.
Yeah, and fortunately, the stock of Digital Campus hasn't budged. So
right,
we
haven't gone IPO yet, so no. I guess we're all set.
Yeah, we haven't broken the buck.
Right. And another institution that I guess we'll have to keep an eye on, since it seems like this Digital Promise new nonprofit corporation is just getting started and really needs funding. Well, one institution that has gotten funding, a $5 million grant from the Knight Foundation, is Tim Berners-Lee's new World Wide Web Foundation. You know, there's the WC3. Or W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, he decided to set up something new. It's at webfoundation.org. Does anyone have a sense of why there needs to be a new institution that focuses on the web and what Tim is trying to do? Of course, our audience probably knows that Tim Berners-Lee was really the creator of the web and really invented it in the late 80s, early 90s.
Stole the idea from Al Gore.
Yes. Gosh. Clearly intercepted his BlackBerry communications. It says on their page, that they're seeking to advance a one web that is free and open, to expand the web's capability and robustness, and to extend the web's benefits to all people on the planet. I'm not exactly sure. Again, this is sort of amorphous. Any thoughts?
Yeah, it is definitely sort of amorphous. As you said, I don't really see how this differs all that much from the W3C. I don't know where the differences are. I mean, I just brought up the W3C's website, and Dan, you just read the Web Foundation's mission statement. The W3C's mission statement is to develop interoperable technologies, specifications, guidelines, software, tools to lead the web to its full potential. It's a forum for information, commerce, communication, and collective understanding. It sounds very similar.
I've always seen, and Steve Bratt, who's the CEO of the new World Wide Web Foundation, is also the CEO of the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3C. I've got this feeling that this new entity has something more to do with kind of cultural and political issues. Cross-border issues. I mean, I've always seen that, when I go to W3C site, I'm often looking for, like, the publication of new web standards or those kinds of things, calls for proposals for web standards. So kind of it's a bit more technical. I have a feeling this is more of a cultural institution to advance the web, to keep it open, a lobbying foundation.
Yeah. And am I wrong about that? The W3C has a big announcement about the creation of the Web Foundation, and maybe it really is kind of the advocacy arm of the W3C. It sort of seems that way, but again, I don't think we quite know yet. Well, probably something to watch.
And watch we will. So we'll keep an eye on those two foundations as they hopefully get established. Well, I suppose that one of the purposes of this new Digital Promise Act and the institution that it will give birth to is to really study the way in which digital media and technology is affecting up-and-coming generations. And indeed, there's been a lot of interest in studying these so-called digital natives, as they were, I guess, named by the Harvard Law professor John Palfrey, in his book on Born Digital. I think that in addition, there have been some efforts here to understand this group, and probably most famously in our corner of the world, the MacArthur Foundation's put a lot of money into studying digital natives and the way they interact with, for instance, video games or the web or mobile technology. And indeed, there's another round of the Digital Media and Learning contest for a grant competition that's coming up in the next few weeks. So we thought we'd spend some time on the feature segment on this episode of Digital Campus, talking a little bit about digital natives, and really, I think our curiosity about them was piqued a little bit more when we read Siva Vaidyanathan's really interesting article in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, the Chronicle Review, when he talks about this really as a myth, that maybe, John Palfrey is not correct, that, there isn't something called a digital native, and that, the students he's encountered, are all over the map technology-wise. They're not completely fluent in digital technology. They don't necessarily jump right in. And also, Palfrey himself sort of came out with a new study this week of young people aged 13 to 22, in which he sort of looked at the way in which they participated in digital technology. And he was thinking, well, maybe if we got them more interested in interacting with the web, in creating content for the web on a blog or YouTube, that they would start using this technology in a kind of better way rather than, you know, perhaps the more less learned ways that they're using the web and other digital technology right now. So I guess we wanted to start off the conversation with just sort of going around the horn. Maybe, Mills, we can start with you about, you know, what's your experience of students in the classroom? How digitally savvy are they? And is there really, let's say, a difference between your undergrad classes and your graduate classes?
Well, you know, I think overall they're just not that savvy. And I think it's really...
So you'd agree with Vaidyanathan that this is a myth?
I would completely agree. I mean, I think that the students who I know, and I spend a lot of time studying undergraduate students and their interactions with technology, and you know, in every class I teach has some kind of a technology component to it, and they struggle with the simplest things like posting a message to a blog or just simply logging in the first time to a blog. I mean, how hard is that? But for more than half of the students in any one of my classes, just setting up an account on a WordPress blog, which is about as easy as it gets, is just insurmountable. They really need me to hold their hands all the way through it. And it's sort of like 10 years ago when I was teaching elsewhere, maybe 15 years ago, and students would come to me and say, okay, I don't have an email address. Can you show me how to set one up? You know, all the students have access to email now because our university requires it, but I think they're just not that savvy. And I think the mistake that we make as educators and as older people looking at younger people is that we see them using technology all the time. They're staring at the little tiny screen of their phone as they're text messaging somebody. They're IMing people on their computers. They're doing things in their Facebook accounts. So they're very facile users of technology to do the things that they want the technology to do. You know, like grab a movie off of BitTorrent or establish 6 new friends on Facebook today or whatever it is. But that is completely different from actually being able to do anything with the technology. They can't create web pages. They don't know how to upload a video to YouTube. They certainly don't know how to edit the video if you've ever watched any of the videos they produce. They just can't do a lot of things. They can't write any HTML code. They don't learn how to program. And so in the same way that, I mean, it's a little bit like me with automobiles. I'm a very good driver, I like to think, but and I can change the oil in my car, and I can fix a flat tire, and that's about as far as it goes. Yeah, anything else, I have to take it to the mechanic. And our students are kind of like that. You know, they're very good drivers of their web browsers, but when it comes to actually being able to do anything more than that, they start to struggle. And so I think it's really been overhyped.
I have the same experience, Mills, and I was actually going to make the same analogy that you did about the automobile. Most people, and let's say the generation that was born immediately after the release of the Model T, I mean, those people could drive a car. They may be able to do things like change the oil, as you said, or fix a flat tire or change some spark plugs or whatever it was. But for any major repairs, they had to bring it to a mechanic. And even going even further, they certainly couldn't design a car. They certainly couldn't build a car. And in fact, there are even specialist users, race car drivers and truck drivers who are even better just plain users of the technology than your average driver. And so, I think it's in many ways, it's a little much for us to expect that this technology would be any different from an earlier technology. I think probably we're in the situation where there are always going to be users and power users and then builders, and that those groups, there might not be a lot of overlap between them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm in general agreement. I might vary a little bit in that. I mean, I do think the way in which I agree is that I think, and it sounds like this is what the two of you are saying as well, that that these young people have a kind of functional view of the technology. Like if they need to do something like text message, then they'll figure that out and they'll do a lot of it. So it's sort of like their experience is a mile wide but an inch deep. I mean, they don't understand the technology itself, but kind of they get situated in things that they need to do, communicate with their friends or, you know, do social networking sort of things, or they'll figure out how to play videos, because that's something that they like to do a lot. But they're not sort of curious about what's behind it, to figure out, let's say, you know, in Flash video, what the action script is behind it, or in a blog, they're not interested in the HTML. It sort of has to be put upon them to actually do a task where it would excite them. And I guess in that way, that's sort of what Palfrey is saying, is that you need to get them interested in the act of creation. That's the only way they're going to learn what's underneath the hood. You know, on the other hand, you know, I still feel a little bit, particularly between my grad classes and, you know, at George Mason, we have graduate students who range from, you know, 24 years old to 74 years old. And I still feel that there is a difference. I mean, if you look across that spectrum, the younger students, you know, there's a higher probability that they will know HTML. There's a higher chance that they've created content on the web. And so I think just in general, the numbers are going up. And, you know, I just, you know, I look at my own kids and, you know, they picked up the mouse right away. They understood how they were going to use it. And, you know, there is something I think about growing up with the technology that has an effect. Now, maybe that is fairly limited, and it kind of makes me wonder about what we should do about that, of how you get students beyond that functional stage so they're not just learning the one thing they need to do to, you know, contact their friend on the web, but to expand out in those other things. Well, Mills, does this, I mean, get into the question of pedagogy and, you know, how we handle young students with technology? I mean, does it mean in your mind, let's say you disagree with what I just said, that everyone starts from first principles. Do you need to start with first principles when you use technology with this group of digital natives?
I don't know that we have to start with first principles, but probably at least with second ones. you know, I give you an example. When I went off to college many, many decades ago, in one of my freshman classes, one of the professors said, okay, you guys are all freshmen. You actually don't know what a university research library is because you've only had high school and public library. So we're heading over to the Alderman Library and we're going to spend an hour learning what a research library is and how it works and how you can get things out of it. And I can't tell you how many times I've blessed that professor because no other course that I took at the university offered me that sort of introduction to the library, not even my historical methods class. And so I learned the difference between a research library and my local public or high school library. And, you know, and that was fabulous. Well, I think that we have to assume that our students know that there is a thing called the internet. And I think we have to assume that they know that you can get information off of it. But I think we owe it to them to then begin teaching them the skills to do the things that they need to do to be successful in college with that tool called the internet and all of its various resources. And so, you know, they don't have to be able to write HTML code to be good successful history majors, but they do have to know how to work with these increasingly massive databases of information like Google Books or the ProQuest Historical Newspapers database or things like that. So I think we can't just say, oh, go to Google Books and find what you need. I think we have to show them how that works. We have to develop exercises to teach them how to do some of these basic things.
Yeah, and I would say that it is the other difference with the internet and the web versus other technologies like, let's say, the car. I mean, the technology is different in that it is easier to teach those kinds of things, and it is easier to get students to a point where they actually are building. I mean, you know, it would take a lot of training to teach me how to, you know, rebuild an engine block or something, but like, you know, building a web page in HTML, it's not that difficult a thing to teach. So I think the barriers, the difference that the internet presents is that the barriers to entry, to move from the just using stage to the actual building stage, the barriers there are much lower. And so I think if we provide help, that the kind of help that Mills is suggesting, it is possible to get them to a place where maybe the place that we think they ought to be already.
But isn't part of the problem here and why perhaps digital natives don't have that much technological know-how is that the progress of the technology itself continues to cover up what's underneath. I mean, you know, when we learned how to make web pages, you sort of had to know HTML, and now you can make a pretty good website using, let's say, WordPress. You don't need to know a thing about HTML. And one expects that will continue to progress in that way. I mean, all these content creation sites, for instance, online video editing sites, you don't have to learn a complicated program like Final Cut Pro. There's some kind of simple Flash-based ways of doing it. So it continues as the technology marches forward to kind of mask what's going on. And, you know, you don't need to know programming. You don't need to know these things. I would expect that would continue and that will, you know, as students grow up with the technology gets smarter and smarter, and so they can remain as dumb as they'd like to be.
It's interesting. I mean, I think that's a fair point, and I think that probably is true that the technology will continue to cover things up. I think, you know, somebody who might be a little older than us might say the same thing about, you know, sort of our abilities, and that, you know, I can use a text editor to write HTML or PHP or some other simple scripting languages, but I can't program the text editor itself. I couldn't build a text editor in C or whatever language it's using to do that. So, you know, maybe it is a process of covering up and covering up. But I think if we can get students in on whatever floor we're at now, they can advance to higher floors. They may not be getting in on the ground floor, you know, at the level of the kernel, but they may be able to get in at a slightly higher floor and then at least advance and keep up as things change.
Well, I'm smiling as we talk about this because I'm reminded of my wife's experience with her father, a theoretical physicist and engineer at Kodak his whole career. And every time she needed help with a math problem in calculus, he would always start with, well, I think first we have to talk about integers. What is an integer? And she would just say, okay, thanks, Dad, and walk away. And so, you know, I think – And of course, he programs still in machine language because, of course, that's very powerful if you can actually do those ones and zeros. But, you know, I don't need to know how to do that because, as Tom said, you know, the technology has made it incredibly easy for me. But I think the bigger problem is that there are an incredible number of resources out there right now for students to use that they have no idea how to use. I mean, you know, my example about Google Books is one.
Right.
You know, as the number of resources, historical primary sources, begins to approach a billion, what are they going to do? How are they going to figure out how to work with that? And I think we're really falling down. We as professional educators are really falling down on the job in not designing learning opportunities for students to teach them how to use these increasingly sophisticated opportunities.
Well, and it really suggests beyond us professors, I mean, I think it really suggests a role for librarians and information specialists to have the kinds of training opportunities. And I know these are out there, but, you know, I realize I don't spend a week at the library with an information specialist or librarian who really knows the ins and outs of, you know, how to do a really good Boolean search on Google or how to mine some of these databases that we've got hundreds and hundreds of databases. And, you know, undoubtedly my students are going to flounder if they just go to one of those databases and just try to plug in keywords. So it seems to me like we have almost a greater onus as educators, and then also as the librarians in our audience, I'm sure, are nodding along that there's a real role there in contemporary education there in those kinds of specialties.
Yeah, I think that the difficult thing here is finding that right floor, that right place of entry where we need the kind of level of sophistication that we need to get students to. You know, figuring out like for the gen ed curriculum, let's say, what do students really need to know about the technology and need to know how to do with the technology? I mean, do they need to know HTML? Maybe not. Do they need to know how to use something like a blog to create a website? Well, maybe. Do they need to know how to scan archival documents? Well, I don't know. But do they need to know how to use archival databases? Well, probably. I mean, finding that sweet spot is I think a very difficult thing. And I think if we can find, you know, come to some agreement, and maybe we never will because the technology is advancing so quickly, but to come to some agreement about what the average college student or high school senior or whatever needs to know about technology, I think that will help us assess really to what extent, you know, are these students digital natives or not.
Well, and you know, we actually at George Mason have, I think, a pretty good set of technology competencies that we expect all of our undergraduates to have when they graduate from college. And it's not that they and they're at different levels. So, you know, most basic, like be able to send and receive an email message or be able to create and print a word process document. And they sort of progress up the hierarchy. And the expectation is that those simplest things you'll be able to do either when you arrive on campus or by the end of your first semester. And by the time you graduate, then you've progressed into the sophisticated level. And I think an awful lot of campuses around the country have some kind of set of technology competencies, but I would be surprised if more than half of the people in our department here at Mason have actually read those competency expectations.
Right, right. You know, even just beyond the basic competencies, though, I guess the final point I would make on this topic is that, you know, we also need to be training for exceptional use of digital technology. And there, you know, when I look around at so-called digital natives, the people we've encountered, for instance, at the Center for History and New Media, who've been doing very, very creative things, is that, you know, you'd want to have beyond just the simple stuff. You want some of these digital natives to really be exploring the boundaries because, you know, we're too old and uncreative at this point in our lives, and we need new people to come in to think about the ways in which this incredibly flexible technology can be used to advance education and learning and understanding. And so, you know, it'd be great to have more kind of advanced training or more opportunities for these students to kind of get involved, get enthusiastic about the technology.
Yeah, and ways to identify them and sort of shepherd them through the training that they would need to do these more advanced things would be great if it existed. I don't think, and I know at least at George Mason that it really doesn't, and we're identifying people kind of haphazardly, and it's not, there isn't something systematic that allows for that kind of creativity and that kind of interest to blossom.
Yeah, and I'm doing an interesting experiment right now in one of my classes where the students are going to, in the second half of the semester, create a pretty good-sized internet project, and there are 17 students in the class, and I asked them on Wednesday to yesterday, I asked them to come to class tomorrow with a list of what they thought they could contribute to this project. You know, were they good researchers? Were they good editors? Did they know video editing? Could they write HTML? And so this is just a kind of random subset of 17 history majors, either juniors or seniors, and it'll be really interesting to see what they come up with.
Time once again, as we do in every podcast, at the end of the podcast, for some exciting picks from our roundtable, things that you might want to take a look at online and maybe even sometimes offline. Mills, what do you have for us this time?
Well, given what we've just been talking about on the need for developing new ways of teaching digital technology to today's students, I'd like to recommend everybody take a look at the National Endowment for the Humanities Teaching Development Fellowships. The first round is, the deadline's actually coming up shortly, October 1, but the application is not that arduous. And this is, in my memory, the first time that the NEH has offered money explicitly for the development of teaching rather than kind of educational projects more generally. And these grants are to focus on one particular course. They don't have to be something to do with digital, but that's our topic here on Digital Campus. But it is a way to improve a particular course. The one hitch is that you have to have taught the course three times already. So it's not to develop a brand new course, but to change an existing course.
Oh,
so
I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, for instance, if you wanted to, you know, digitalize some aspect of a course that you were already teaching and you taught a number of times, then this would be a great grant to apply from. And it's, you know, it's real money. It's enough to buy you out of a class and have a little money left over. And so it's definitely worth taking a look at.
Great. We'll take a look. Tom, what do you have for us this time?
Well, in the last segment, I was mentioning that it is difficult to identify those kind of those exceptional kind of creative students who really want to engage the technology and do something more with it. This week I've got an episode of a podcast of the Chronicle of Higher Education's Tech Therapy podcast, episode 31, called "What to Look for in Tech Staff," and it's just a discussion of the kinds of things if you're running a digital humanities center or you've just gotten a grant to do a digital humanities project and you need to hire some tech staff. Hiring technical staff can be a really difficult thing because it's hard to tell what people's skills really are. A lot of times you'll get a stack of resumes and they all have the same sort of alphabet soup on them. I know XML and PHP and JavaScript and C and C++ and, you know, all of those things. And it's hard to identify the people who really know from the people who don't and from the people who are going to be enthusiastic and creative from the people who are just going to be kind of what sometimes we call code monkeys. And so this podcast just gives some tips for navigating those waters and identifying the kinds of people who you really want to have on board for your digital humanities project or center or educational technology project.
Sounds great. Thanks very much. We will take a look. Well, I'm actually going to recommend a book. Although since this is Digital Campus, the book is freely available online, and it is the Companion to Digital Literary Studies, edited by Susan Tribeman and Ray Siemens. And kudos to them, and also to Blackwell Publishing for allowing them to put it online for free. As with all of these, we'll link to this from digitalcampus.tv. It's got a rather long URL. But, you know, if you remember back to a few years ago, Tribeman and Siemens actually edited and actually I think John Unsworth was involved as well, and I hope I've gotten all the editors correctly, but they had a Companion to Digital Humanities, which I recommend you check out. Many chapters by many of the leaders in the field, and this time they've tackled literary studies, and there's a lot of really interesting articles or chapters in this very large volume. They're all available now online, and they range from things like, you know, an analysis of what reading online is and what it means to read online versus offline, to digital poetry, to digital games, to blogging. There's an interesting chapter on the nature of blogging, to things like digital libraries and collections and electronic scholarly editions. So it's really a comprehensive volume that I think moves even beyond just literary studies and might be useful to a lot of the people in our audience. Well, Tom Mills, thanks again for joining me on the podcast, on our podcast, and it's great to always talk. And good luck with all those natives in your classes, and we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.